We identified as being Satan because the Bible said he was representing Satan in Revelation 12, verse 9. Well, that great red dragon is joined by two other evil beings in chapter 13. We saw in the first half of this chapter that there was the sea beast, the beast that came up that had characteristics like a lion and a bear and a leopard and the diverse beasts of Daniel chapter 7. And now picking up tonight where we ended last week in verse number 11, we find that there is another beast. This one you could identify as the land beast in opposition to the sea beast. Someone said that if the sea beast is Satan's right hand, then the land beast is his left hand. So these are allies of the devil. And they've come up together in chapter 13. We're going to find that they go down together in chapter 19. So they are in scripture tied to each other throughout. In fact, we might look over to chapter 19, verse 10. I think it's verse 10. And see how that they will, they will go down together in the war that's taking. Let's just go to chapter 20, verse 10. We'll see all of them in one verse. Revelation 20, 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. So eventually Satan, the sea beast, and the land beast are all going to suffer the judgment of God. But in chapter 13, we find that they are on the ascension. They are in control. They have the upper hand against God's people. And we're going to try to determine what this represents. Let's read together beginning of verse 11 and see some details. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb. Now, if you could picture in your mind a lamb, then you know that that's a gentle animal. There's nothing ferocious or dangerous about a little lamb. That's also a religious symbol, one of many religious symbols that you might see depicting in graphic form, a religious connotation. So here you have something that's appears to be gentle, appears to be innocuous, appears not to be harmful. Also, that is couched in religious symbols. But the last part of the verse says, "And he spake as a dragon, not a innocent baa of the lamb." But his true colors came out when he spoke. The dragon, of course, we've already identified as Satan. So here is something that, some entity that looks innocent, but it's carrying out the voice or the teaching, the will of the devil. Now, we identified in chapter 13, 1 through 10, that the sea beast was the Roman government that was leading a persecution against the Christians. We'll see more about the Caesar or emperor himself toward the end of class tonight. So if you have in the first half the government represented by the sea beast, what does the land beast represent? I believe that it represents the pagan religion that the government used to enforce emperor worship upon the people. Let's see that as we go through tonight in this section. Notice first that you have the devil who is using these other entities to harm God's people to carry out his purposes. Notice in this same verse, the voice reveals the true character. I mentioned that, but I wanted to turn over with you to John chapter 8, if you don't mind. And let's read together probably a familiar verse to most of us, but to be reminded of the voice of Satan, and you also see that as early as Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, when he has a conversation as the serpent with Mother Eve. You remember when he opened his mouth, he told a lie. He did not represent the truth. He said, "Thou shalt not surely die." God had said, "Thou shalt surely die." And so he contradicted God, and God is the God of truth, never lies. Satan is the God of lies and always lies. That's what we see in John 8:44. Jesus is speaking to his contemporaries that were not righteous men. He said, ye are of your father, the devil, John 8:44, and the lust of your father ye will do. Now notice these three characteristics of Satan in this verse. He, I've drawn a circle around the word he and put a little number one beside it, and I wrote in the margin, he's a real person. Now I know in our modern culture, just about two, three, or four weeks ago, one of the Supreme Court justices made reference to the devil, and that's been carried in the news now for about 2 weeks, how one of our Supreme Court justices believes, he just quoted C.S. Lewis, a quote about the devil. Well, people don't believe in the devil anymore. They think that we left that behind somewhere in elementary school. That's something that children believe in, but grown men who are intelligent and educated could not believe in a personal devil. But if you believe the Bible, then you believe in a personal devil because Jesus believed in him. He said he was a murderer. That's a masculine personal pronoun representing a real person. He was a, and I put a little number two beside the next word, murderer. That's the second characteristic of Satan. He's not innocuous. He's not innocent. He's not out to have a good time and leading us in a good time. Satan is a murderer. You see that again with Adam and Eve. Thou shalt surely die, God said. Satan said, you shall not surely die. They listened to Satan and they died on the day they took that fruit. They died spiritually. They were separated from God, driven from the garden. They also eventually died because of that error physically, and they brought death upon all of humankind because they listened to the devil. He is a murderer. Every death, every trip to the cemetery, every marker that's in any cemetery in any place on the earth can go back to its originator. That originator is Satan the murderer. He, personal, a real individual. Number two, a murderer. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar. Put a number three beside liar. That's the third characteristic of Satan. He is a murderer, he is a liar, and the father of it. So every lie that's ever been told can go back to that original lie, the example set by Satan in Genesis chapter 3. Now, you might also note on this same point, Matthew 7 and verse 15. So flip back a few pages further toward the front of the Bible and get to Matthew 7. And let's see this false religion aspect of this symbolism here. We're going to see that this same being is going to be called the false prophet in Revelation 16, 13, Revelation 19, 20. So it's easier to determine that he is tied to a religious emphasis because he's called a prophet, a false prophet in these other passages. Now, Matthew 7, 15, Jesus gives us a warning about false prophets. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing. Now, you notice in Revelation 13, 10, 11, where we are, he appears to be a lamb. That's sheep's clothing. Well, what does it mean to come in sheep's clothing? What does that, we know what the figure is, but what does it mean? What's he really warning us about? Deception. That's right. Appears to be something isn't. A lamb appears to be innocent, but he speaks with the voice of Satan. Here is someone dressed in nice clothes, good looking, very articulate. Well, don't judge by externals. When he stands before the audience to speak, does he speak the words of God or does he pervert them? If he speaks the words of God, he is to be trusted regardless of his externals. But if he does not speak the words of God, if he leads men into error, if he's a false prophet, then he is the opposite of good and he's not to be trusted. Notice in the second part of the verse, they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. So you see that voice coming out that sounded like the dragon. Be careful who you listen to. Be careful how you hear, Mark 4:24, because what you believe will determine what you obey and how you behave, and then that will determine your judgment at last. So be careful what you hear. Be careful how you take in what you hear. Make sure that if it's truth, that you accept it and obey it, but if it's error, that you reject it and do not obey it. Now, another passage on the same point is 2 Corinthians 11, verse 15, which talks about the ministers of Satan. They, again, appear as the ministers of God, but they are not. They are only an appearance They're imitators of that which is good, but they're not according to truth. All right, we'll go back to Revelation. You can read that verse. I hear some of you turning to it. Go ahead and read it for your own personal benefit. We're going to go ahead and keep the pace up and go back to Revelation 13 and pick up in the next verse, verse 12. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast. First beast, the sea beast, represented Roman government. So the second beast is in cohorts with him. And the first beast gives the second beast his power. They share power. Now that makes a lot of sense if you're talking about the worship of the emperor through this false religion. For instance, Domitian, who is, we believe, the emperor during the time that John is writing this book, and he came to power in AD 81 and died in AD 96, probably written toward the end of his reign. And he was a man who desired to be worshipped. He wanted people to address him as the supreme Lord and God. In fact, he would not even receive correspondence unless it had that as its salutation, addressing him as a God. Well, here you have, and not only did he do that, before I go further, he also set up images of himself throughout the empire for people to bow down to, for people to worship. So here is a man who desired to be worshipped and required people to burn incense to his image, and they could, otherwise they could not receive permission to do such things as go to the market and purchase food or engage in a marriage or have a will or transfer property. All those you had to have the mark of the beast that we'll talk about in a few minutes. So here he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. You see, the second beast is causing the earth to worship the first beast. Second beast, false religion. First beast, represented by the emperor, and is requiring all the earth to worship the false beast. Notice that there's no exceptions to that. All the earth. This was, from the Roman perspective, the earth was the known world, the inhabited world, which was the Roman Empire. The Mediterranean Sea, for instance, meaning middle of the earth, to the Romans, that was the sea that was in the middle of the earth because that was their empire. That was the known world. And they, and in all those regions, far flung from Rome itself, the influence of the emperor was felt and the requirement to worship him was enforced, even as far as down in Egypt. So here the first beast is worshipped because the second beast causes the whole earth to bow before him to worship the beast whose deadly wound was healed. That refers, of course, back to the early part of the chapter where one of the seven heads had a wound unto death. But later, the wound was healed. It came back alive. We interpreted that to refer to Nero, who had begun the persecution against Christians in the AD 60s. And then he died unexpectedly. And the persecution of the Christians stopped for a time. It subsided under Vespasian and Titus, the next two Roman emperors. But then when Domitian came along in AD 81, he revived the spirit of Nero. He was just as hateful or more so toward the Christians than Nero had been. So here you have a reference back to that same, the deadly wound, the attitude of Nero reincarnated in Domitian, who persecuted the Christians with vengeance. All right, let's see if there's anything else on verse 12. I might mention that if you, as some of you may have, visit Ephesus even to this day, you can still see the great temples that were built to the Roman emperors, Vespasian, Titus, Domitian, and Trajan. Trajan followed Domitian, and he also was a great persecutor of Christians. So you see that the Caesars desired worship, they demanded worship, and they enforced that worship. Even the Jews compromised in this way to avoid persecution. They agreed that they would pray for the emperor and for his king and for his empire. And so they, by and large, were not persecuted. Christians would not do that, and they were persecuted. If you wanted to outline this chapter or just have some key words that would help to remember the key ideas here, let me just give you four that I'll start with a W And we've already covered worship in verse 4. So you have the desire of worship for, the dragon desires to be worshiped. That's in verse 4. And then we saw in verse 7 that he made war against God and his forces. And here in verse 13, where we're about to read, he has wonders by which he deceives the people. And then we'll see in a few minutes, verse 17, great wealth is on his side. So there's worship, war, wonders, and wealth as summary words of this, of the enemy of Christians here. All right, verse 13 now. And he doeth great wonders so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Now what we have observed so far is that God has in his arsenal certain weapons to use against Satan. And Satan will imitate those. In this case, we saw in chapter 11 and chapter 12 that the two witnesses were able, this is chapter 11 about verse 5, and if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies, and if any man will hurt them, he must in this matter be killed. We studied that a few weeks ago. And now, so that was true power on God's side, the power of the gospel. But in this case, Satan has his fire that comes down from heaven. It's a lying wonder. It's not true, but it's deceiving the people. We might notice a couple of verses on that. We studied recently about miracles, so I won't spend a lot of time going back through some of these same verses. But I thought we would look at maybe three verses that are good commentary on that concept. The first is Matthew 24, verse 24. This is the section of the Olivet Discourse where Jesus is discussing the destruction of the temple by the Romans in AD 70. He was asked the question, when shall these things be, when the temple be destroyed? And then what will be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And he's answering those questions in that order. And the verse 24 is in the answer to that first question. And he says, for there shall arise false Christs. Remember, we've been talking about deception. Open the mouth, the voice of the dragon. And false prophets. And shall show, notice in connection with false teaching, is false wonders. And shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. So there has often been this connection between false teaching and false wonders or false miracles. You see it again in Acts chapter 8, for instance. In fact, turn over there and let's see it with Simon the sorcerer. You remember the gospel went out from Jerusalem and then Judea. And then the third area as it advanced from its origination point in Jerusalem, it came to Samaria. And when it came to Samaria, the preachers of the gospel encountered a certain man who had a great reputation in that area as being a wonder worker, as having the power of God. And they had been deceived for a long time by this person. Here in Acts 8, let's pick up about, I guess we'll pick up about verse 6 maybe, let's see. And the people with one accord gave heed unto those things which Philip spake, hearing and seeing the miracles which he did. So here is the gospel preacher working real miracles. He had his hands laid on by the apostles, and he's working, he's able to work miracles. And then you see in the next verse, for unclean spirits crying out with loud voice came out of many that were possessed with them, and many were taken with palsies, and that were lame were healed. So power over demon possession, power over physical ailments, disease. And there was a great joy in that city, because those who were sick and demon-possessed were made whole, and also salvation had come to their city. Now, verse 9, but there was a certain man called Simon, which before time in the same city used sorcery, magic. You know, we have our illusionists today, and they're not, David Copperfield, that variety, David Copperfield. They don't make themselves out to be some religious power, but they're illusionists. You watch them and you're amazed. How do they do that? How could they accomplish that? Well, There have been men like that in every generation who've been able to cause the people to wonder. Simon used it for his personal benefit and claiming to get that power from God. And you continue in the reading, it says, man bewitched. That word's going to be used twice in this context. Sorcery, and then he bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one, to whom they all gave heed, from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is the great power of God. See, they had been deceived by the false wonders before Philip came to their city. And to him they had regard, because that of a long time he had bewitched them with sorceries. But when they believed Philip preaching the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ, they were baptized, both men and women. And Simon himself believed also. And when he was baptized, he continued with Philip and wondered and beholding the miracles and signs which were done. So now Simon is seeing real miracles, and he's in awe of that. He's watching, he's beholding it. And then if you've read, as I know you have, the rest of the chapter, he tries to purchase not the ability to work the miracles. He wanted something better than that. He wanted the ability to be able to lay hands on other people and let them work the miracles. But, of course, the apostles rebuked him for that, and he asked them to pray for him. But I just wanted to read that in your hearing so that we could see the connection between false teaching and these false wonders. One other passage on this is 2 Thessalonians. I think we read this in our series recently, so I won't go into a lot of detail, but I think for the benefit of tonight's lesson, it would help us to read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning of verse 9, just to see the same concept, a little different perspective. 2 Thessalonians 2, beginning in verse 9. Even him, that's speaking of Satan, or the one led by Satan, whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs. And I think the key word of the whole verse is lying wonders. The lying really modifies all of those words, power, signs, and wonders. So he's been given the ability to deceive others as if he had great power, as if he had was able to lead others to wonder or put them in awe. And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness and them that perish because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So you see that common thread. It's not just found in the book of Revelation. It's not just found in this figurative language of the beast and the lamb, as a lamb with the voice of the dragon. You could see the same idea in other places in Scripture. Beware of false prophets. See the connection between tricking people with deceiving wonders and signs and great power that appears to be the power of God, but it is not. So we see that as we go back now to Revelation. The same idea we had been warned about by Jesus early on in the Sermon on the Mount, and then as a little bit later toward the end of his ministry, in fact at the very end of his ministry, the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 22, that's on Tuesday of the Crucifixion Week. So the first sermon, Matthew chapter 5 through 7, he warns about false prophets. His last sermon, the last week of his life, he warns about false prophets. So you see how that was on Jesus' mind and how it ought to be on ours. And it's here in Revelation 13. All right, you might also put down, if you're taking notes tonight, 2 Timothy 3:13, same point. Now let's move into the next verse, 13. Verse 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast. He talked about those images put in all the cities for people to worship. Incidentally, Trajan, after he came to power, he melted those things and put them to better use. There were images of his predecessor. You could see why he wouldn't be especially interested in them. But he did not make all of them into his image. He put them into some other purposes. Even though he desired worship and demanded it, he was not as image conscious in the literal sense as his, as Domitian had been. So, but you see that idea here in verse 14. They should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live. That fits with the interpretation of Nero, the wound, but then resurrected in Domitian. And so he had the wound, but he's alive, and so he's demanding to be worshipped. And that was a reality for Christians living in that century. We might just mention the middle part of the verse. No, let's just go ahead and go to the next one. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Christians were given a choice. Try to put yourself back in that generation. Here you are, just let's say a young Christian, maybe young husband, wife, and children at home. You're just trying to earn a living. You've come to know Christ and you've been converted. You were baptized. And now the emperor has enacted these laws. Maybe you've been a Christian, let's say a year, 5 years, short amount of time. And the enforcers of the law saying everyone's got to bow down to this image and say Caesar is Lord. Or be killed. Actually, there were four levels. They could arrest you, imprison you, torture you, or execute you. And often that would be in that order. It would not necessarily be killed the first time you refused to worship the image of the emperor, but they could arrest you. So, and they could kill you. It was legal to do so. So here they're given the choice. Do I say Caesar is Lord? Or Christ is Lord. You can't have two lords. Either one or the other. You can't say, well, you know, fingers behind my back crossed, I'll just say Caesar's Lord to get the certificate or to get the mark of the beast. No, it's, and some people tried that. And they were withdrawn, the fellowship was withdrawn from them as it should have been from the church. You can't have a false religion. You can't worship an image and claim to be a Christian. So here the choice was, a literal choice, if I say Caesar is Lord, then I've chosen eternal death. If I say Christ is Lord, I've chosen immediate death. Which one do I want? Immediate death at the Roman, at the hand of the Roman executor? Or eternal death? Well, obviously the spiritually minded person chose the first instead of the second. And there are no good records of how many Christians died during the 200 years. I did a little research on it. At the very minimum, there were thousands of Christians who were executed by the Roman government. The upper end of it, 6 million. Some say there were 6 million Christians that died in the 225 years, roughly, between the time that Domitian became emperor until Constantine signed the Edict of Milan in AD 313. Thousands of Christians had to make that choice. Now you think about in your case, what choice would you make? What choice would I make? Here as a husband, as a father, if I die, what's going to happen to my wife? Are my children going to be turned to orphans? Are they going to survive? That would be a tough choice to make. But the right choice had to be made because of the example one was set for one thing, for his children, for his wife, for the other Christians, but also, of course, the most obvious one, for his salvation. I wanted to mention here some of the ways that Christians were killed. Some of this is really gruesome. I'm not going to go into detail about it, but I don't want us to somehow just pass over this and think, well, you know, it was an easy thing that our brethren endured. You could read a book like Fox's Book of Martyrs. It goes into a lot of detail about the martyrdoms of Christians. But just to mention four, some were eaten by animals. They would wrap up Christians in animal skins, turn hungry wild animals in the Colosseum loose on the Christians, and they would attack them. Two, some of them were set on fire. Nero, for instance, is said to have dipped Christians in wax, hung them from poles in his gardens, and set them on fire to light his gardens at night. Others were tied to the wheel of a chariot and rolled over the cobblestone streets until they were pulled apart or cut apart. And others were crucified. The tradition about Peter, for instance, is that he was crucified, but he asked to be crucified upside down instead of right side up because he did not want to die as his Lord had died. There were many inventive ways that they chose to kill the Christians as this persecution went on. There were 10 imperial persecutions against Christians. If you start with Nero, which is more localized, and then Domitian's empire-wide, and then Trajan, and all the way down to Diocletian and Galerius toward the end of the 200s, vicious persecution under Diocletian, for instance. Well, that's all we'll say about that. Let's go to the next verse. We'll have time to talk about the mark of the beast. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. The word mark here is in contradistinction to the mark of chapter 7, verse 3, that God placed. You remember before he unleashed some of those plagues against those who were his enemies, those measured responses? Before he let the angels loose to do that, you remember that he had another angel to put a mark on the forehead of all the Christians so they would not be caught up in that. Well, now the devil has his false mark. God has his true mark. He knows those who are his. Not a single one will be lost that should be saved, nor will a single one be saved who should be lost. God knows the ones who are saved, who are his. Now the devil has to imitate that. And the devil has the mark. In this case, it's the word, it can be translated stamp, like you go into, we used to go to Six Flags when I was a kid, and you'd get a stamp on your hand that would let you, you know, go out in maybe infrared or whatever that, you could come back in later if you left. It can mean an etching, like a tattoo. Some of the pagans, for instance, if you worshiped a certain god, then you would have his tattoo on you. Maybe on your hand, maybe on your face, somewhere prominent to show that you belong to that god. It could also mean an engraving, like a burn, a scar, like a branding. And of course, branding has become more popular, which is crazy to me, but branding has become popular again. But we're all familiar with branding of animals, but that's taken place a long time. That's been something. Slaves were often branded in ancient Rome. Horses were branded. It could mean literal. They could have received a literal mark, like some religions have the mark in the forehead even to this hour. Some have, am I hearing things up here? Is it? I lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, mark. It could be literal, or it could be just a certificate, such as something you could show when you went to the courthouse to say, I'm going to sell this property. Well, do you have your license? Do you have your mark of the beast? Do you have your labellus? If you didn't worship the Caesar, then you didn't have the certificate. You couldn't show it. If you couldn't show it, you didn't have permission to engage in this marriage or to sell this property or to enact this will, even to pass property down from one generation to another. Or, as we mentioned when we were studying in chapters 2 and 3, you couldn't even get on with one of the trade unions because they also enforced the labellus. So you couldn't get in the good jobs because... And you couldn't even purchase at the marketplace. So all those things made it hard. So they had to have the mark of the beast. No man has the right to sell, buy or sell, verse 17, save he that hath the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And before I go into this, make sure I didn't leave out anything I really wanted to say. I guess we'll point out what might be obvious here, but from the big picture perspective, what you have when you marry political power with economic wealth, and you bring those together, you have total control of a society. You have the law on your side, but you also have the means to be successful, the means to earn a living. And so when the devil brought the sea beast and the land beast and tied with it economic success or economic ability, then he is bringing a tremendous force against the Christians. They are helpless. They are the huddled masses that really don't have, they can't appeal to government. Government's against them. They can't even earn a living for their families easily, and they are under threat of being arrested or even executed for no other reason than they will not worship the Caesar. They will not bow to his image. This reminds us, do you remember way back in chapter 6 when we were talking about the horses? There was the red horse, the white horse, and the red horse, and the black horse, and the pale horse. Remember the black horse? And he that rode on it had this balanced scales in his hand. Anyone remember what we said that meant? It was a long time ago, wasn't it? We said that that meant dearth or famine or economic hardship. Here you're down to measuring amounts of food on a scale. You don't have, if you're measuring it, you don't have very much. And how much are we each going to get? Well, here we're going to divide this evenly. We'll measure it. How much do we have for today and for tomorrow? We want to make sure we have some for the next few days. We can only eat this much today and we'll have some for tomorrow. So if you're measuring it, you don't have much. So that black horse represented scarcity brought on by persecution. We're right back to the black horse here in this section of Revelation chapter 13. That brings us to verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him that understand, that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And his number is 666. This is one of the most talked about sections of Revelation. One of the most widely argued sections of the book of Revelation. What does the mark of the beast mean? What does the number 666 represent? Well, there are some who will go back to an ancient method of assigning an amount to a letter and then adding up the letters to give it a numerical equivalent. If you took, for instance, Nero Caesar, and you put it in Hebrew letters and then you assigned their normal value, it would equal 666. Some people say this refers to Nero. That seems a little far-fetched to me for this reason. One, because John was writing in Greek to Greek-speaking people. Why would they translate it into Hebrew? And if they did, would they even be able to understand it? A couple other times in the book, he will take pains to explain Hebrew words to them that he uses. So these are not natural-speaking Hebrews, at least many of them, that would read the book. If you gave it the Greek spelling, it would equal 1,005, so it wouldn't fit at all. Well, long story short, you could find just about any interpretation you want. Many of the popes have been represented by 666 in popular literature. Many other world's leaders have been, Hitler, for instance, was widely thought to be 666 in that generation. Many people believe that it represents some evil leader that's going to come on the scene at the end of time or just before the, quote, tribulation. And none of that is found in this verse in my judgment. What is it saying? Well, there are two ideas. I think this is the primary one. The book of Revelation uses numbers to represent ideas. We've seen that all the way through the book. What does the number 7 represent? Perfection. Or God, the Holy Spirit, 7 spirits of God, perfect spirit of God. So if 7 is perfect, what's 6? Less than perfect. If 7 is the number of God, what would 6 be? The human number. In fact, in the Jewish culture, I read that 6 represented a number of dread, like an unlucky 13 in our culture. 6 was their unlucky 13. And if you tripled it, it meant complete disaster. 666. Well, maybe that has a connection here. Some say that it represents the Caesar who is in power at the time John wrote the book. That would make a lot of sense. So the number of a man is the number of Domitian, who was leading the persecution against Christians. And what that would mean, well, let me throw in the other interpretation, which is similar, and then I'll tie it together as we close our class. Homer Haley, in his book that we've referred to several times, says that it doesn't represent any single individual. The letter, the article A, is not found in the Greek. It's the number of a man, King James Version has. It's the number of man in the Greek. There's no A there. So he says it's the number, it represents humanity and humanity's plan to fight against God, which is doomed to fail. He's going to fall short every time because he's six and he's not seven. Seven's always going to beat six. Well, that makes a lot of sense. But either way, if you take it to be just a metaphorical in the sense that it represents any evil man who fights against God's people, then Domitian would certainly fit in that number. Or if you wanted to make it apply to a certain individual, then Domitian would be a likely candidate for that. But the thing I want to close with is to put yourself in the place of those Christians living in that time when they were threatened and they knew people that had been arrested or killed and so forth. Well, you would feel like the devil's going to beat us. The devil's got everything on his side. He's got the government. He's got the culture. He's got the wealth. He's got everything sewed up against us. There's no way we'll survive this. And John, through the Spirit, writes this, 666. You remember that, Christians? This is doomed to fail. It is not divine. It's a human number, and God is always going to defeat the devil. So there would be comfort in that, in the sense that even though they had the upper hand in the short term, they would not win in the end. And that's the message that we've seen several times under different figures in the book of Revelation. Well, we've used up a couple extra minutes, so that'll be as far as we can go tonight. But next week is our gospel meeting, so we'll pick up after that, Lord willing.